Oh, you mean for the audiobook?
For the audiobook, yeah, yeah.
Who do you want to read it?
Who would you like? Want to read it?
James Earl Jones has passed away, sadly. That was a good one.
Who?
James Earl Jones.
Oh, yeah, right, right. Now I'm thinking like Mao Zedong, you know, you could AI him. That would be an interesting one.
Okay, so you'd have Mao reading it in his, but it translates to English. So it would be like
something
when they
like that.
Those AI.
Have you ever
Eric
heard
Adams?
Mao talk? He's got a very high pitched voice.
I don't think I have.
Yeah. Also, Huey Newton, terrible voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. You pull up some clips. There's a reason Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Seale were kind of the spokesman. Huey just didn't. He's not an orator.
Well, the goat was Paul Robeson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's right. Robeson had everything. He had presence, voice, intelligence. Yep.
He was an athlete.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why they had to take him down. And that's what we're talking about today. We can just get started.
Oh, hold on. Let me remove this. Just distraction. You don't need to see my socks drying.
Well, it's just going to be audio.
Yeah, I know you're not filming. It's kind of a psychological thing.
Okay. Yeah, makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. You know, kind of trying to dignify the thing with a little bit of a office feng shui.
Sure. Well, you got to get like a ton of books in the background, and it could almost be all of your books because you've put out so many, and we always have you on the show when you do. Always appreciate reading your work. It focuses on the history of repression, mainly against U.S. communists and leftists, and obviously,
exactly, yeah.
Obviously, that has been relevant, and it's probably more relevant today than at any point we've had you on in the past. And your book, this one is specifically about the suppression of the Communist Party USA, Menace of Our Time. So why did you choose to focus on the CPUSA for this one?
Yeah, it's an interesting process. You know, my first book was on U.S. Maoists, you know, mainly the Revolutionary Union, which emerged in late 1968 and kind of became the biggest radical force in the early 70s. I mean, that's a whole book. But kind of working on that book, one of the things that I discovered is that the Communist Party USA, nobody's really done a lot of investigation or at least a lot of writing on the suppression aimed at them. And what I discovered with the Revolutionary Union is a lot of the doctrine and methodology that the FBI had developed actually had its roots in what they did in the Communist Party USA. So it's this huge story needing to be told, which, you know, I didn't think I was going to be the one to try to tell it. And I don't think I'm the one who's told it comprehensively, but I do think I've made a reasonable first pass at trying to put it all together. But that's kind of what led me to kind of go take a step back from the tumult of the late 60s, early 70s, you know, more into the 20th century as a whole and how the powers that be, such as it were, you know, targeted radical communism.
Yeah, and I think it's a very familiar story to me because you and I do some similar research. But focusing on the CPUSA really helped me understand the way this repression kind of developed over time. But it's important that it doesn't begin with the CPUSA or even with communism, but it begins with anarchism. And that's obviously a big kind of parallel to our current moment where we don't have, you know, communism. You know, Trump talks about communism, especially in regards to Zoran, but it's really anarchism and occasionally anarcho-Marxism that has been the target of the new security declarations, the designation of Antifa as a terrorist organization. And so we're coming full circle here with this criminal anarchy charge that sort of frames the entire legal repressive framework. So let's start at the beginning. How did anarchism become the first target of what would be several rounds of red scares, black scares, etc.?
Yeah, well, as you're speaking, I'm thinking, you know, if I had another 80 years to live and write, I'd probably have to kind of tip back into the late 19th century to see all of what was happening against the arising socialist movement and such, which kind of is what brings us to the threshold of the 20th century, which is the topic I'm talking about. So my book opens with the assassination of William McKinley. So there's a contemporary relevance there. I mean, there's been a fair amount of talk about Trump early on, you know, kind of resurrecting the, you know, carcass or specter of William McKinley in terms of tariffs and U.S. isolation and things like that.
I forgot about that. He was talking about McKinley nonstop at the beginning of the administration, but he doesn't talk about him so much anymore.
Yeah, right. Well, everything changes so rapidly. But, you know, I open the book, there's this exposition in Buffalo, and there's this huge fireworks display. And it's, I don't know if it spells it out in the display, but at some point, I think there's a banner that reads, Welcome President McKinley, who's coming to the event. He's being feted. It says, Welcome McKinley, President of our Republic and our Empire. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but, you know, pretty brazenly talking about the U.S. ascending the world stage as an empire. They had just finished the Spanish-American War, where they had grabbed Cuba, the Philippines, Hawaii had been appropriated, and it was pretty unabashed and unembarrassed.
This is 1901, right?
Exactly. And it's a pretty unabashed embrace of that. McKinley, the next day, he's in a meet-and-greet line, and this guy comes up with his hand in a handkerchief, which is actually disguised as a, you know, concealing a weapon. And he shoots McKinley, who they think is going to live, but he holds on for a few days, but he succumbs. The guy, Zagoz, C-G-O-S-L-Z.
I hear Chogol sometimes, but yeah, I always hear it a different way.
Pronunciations I have to work on myself, but he's an anarchist. He subscribes to the act of the deed, and there is this huge, it's not a Red Scare per se, but there's a hue and cry against anarchism. New York State, which is the most populous state in the country, New York City is the center of the empire. Yeah, so New York State passes this law against criminal anarchy, which it's not even, you know, look, it's always illegal to undertake political violence. This law takes it a step further and says, you know, you can't print, write, distribute, teach precepts of overthrowing the government. This is the law that happens to be invoked pretty intensely in 1920 after anarchists bombed the apartment or the home of Mitchell Palmer, who is the attorney general. Mm-hmm. Interesting side point is his neighbor is Franklin Roosevelt, lives across the street. Wow. Roosevelt, you know, looks at the remains of the anarchist who has blown himself up essentially, and by looking at his socks says, oh, he's a poor person, which I just thought that was a kind of an interesting little piece that was in the New York Times coverage, but it shows you kind of the patrician nature of FDR rather than this populist, but that's an aside. So then there's, you know, this is major. You try to kill the attorney general, and there's just this huge effort to round up anarchists and communists, even though communists essentially, you know, have a totally different doctrine. They're not into this excitative terror. You know, they're looking at the revolution in the Soviet, in Russia that had just happened, and they're modeling themselves after that. They're thinking, you know, we are on the cusp of a wave of world revolution, you know, coming off of World War One. I mean, that's a whole discussion in its own right. But J. Edgar Hoover, who has an up-and-comer in the Bureau of Investigation, soon to be the Federal Bureau of Investigation, has modernized the agency by compiling a filing system. Hoover, I believe, worked in the Library of Congress. So he's a good bureaucrat in the kind of the neutral sense of the term in terms of organizing bureaucracies. And he's very good at compiling lists. You know, it'd be an interesting thought experiment to see what J. Edgar Hoover could do with AI, kind of given his organizational sensibility. But he compiles lists. And he uses those lists after the Palmer incident to round up thousands of some anarchists, but a lot of communists. The communists have foreign clubs like Finnish clubs, Latvian clubs. It's mainly foreign language organizations, but they're all rounded up. Several hundred are actually deported. The rest are kind of held in custody, eventually released as the tide changes. But one of the people who's caught up is this guy, Gitlo, who is a communist. He's put in prison with several others, and he's charged under the criminal anarchy law, which the Supreme Court upholds. And they write this decision, you know, basically saying, I'm going to paraphrase, you know, look, we don't have to wait until the fires consume the whole building. As soon as we see sparks, we can act, which basically becomes doctrine for the next 50 years to say that if you write or teach, you know, this notion of communism, we can put you in prison. So
yeah, so the criminal anarchy law, the original one against Chogol, made it a felony to advocate for revolution. So what, not just planning for it or carrying it out, but just to advocate for it. And this was used in the Palmer raids, it sounds like, against communists in addition to anarchists. Was it used previously when they were rounding up dissidents to World War One, specifically IWW type people?
I think the, you know, I can't answer that comprehensively. I think there was a couple of laws passed during World War One that prescribed any kind of anti-war advocacy. Some of the leaders like Earl Browder was put in prison under these early laws that were passed in World War One, which was not criminal anarchy. Also, even the Seven-Day Adventists, I think, were targeted.
I'm just looking up the charges here because I'm writing this book about baseball, right? And so part of the story of baseball is Kenesaw Landis was the first commissioner. Previous to that, he was a federal judge, and he was one of the people who locked up a bunch of these IWW people. I think it was the Espionage Act.
Yeah, exactly. And there was another one. There were two laws during World War One that were used. It was the Espionage Act. I don't think it was the Enemy Alien Act, but okay, but let's get back on track here. The criminal anarchy laws passed in New York, in the wake of that law, something like 30 states over the next 5 to 10 years passed some version of either criminal anarchy or criminal syndicalism. And it's all geared toward the same thing, essentially saying certain speech is going to be prohibited. And it's not so much that the authorities are worried about speech as, you know, they're using it as an instrument to contain and imprison people who are railing against, you know, the standing order. I mean, after World War One and the Bolshevik Revolution, the United States in 1920 is not the country that it would become. It's still an emerging power. It's not the greatest superpower to ever exist. It doesn't have nuclear weapons, and the governmental structure is still evolving. I think actually going into the Civil War, the major federal institution was the military. So, you know, you're fast forwarding what, 30 years later, you know, some of this stuff has evolved, but it's not all of, you know, what it would later become. The FBI was a nascent organization. It wasn't this behemoth that it would become after World War II. So these laws are passed all across the country. There is a real concern about communist agitation. I mean, Lenin had kind of sent a chill throughout, you know, the entire U.S. power structure that this small almost forgettable force could actually topple a government and seize power. So it seemed like a lot of things were possible. So there was a certain panic going on by the authorities.
We're still talking about the Palmer raid and the reaction shortly after that.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I almost feel like I want to start over again. I feel like I'm. Can you give me like 15 minutes and we can? Because I feel like I'm muddling here and I'm not doing your listeners a service.
You can definitely take 15. I'm going to edit this really well. I think we are fine as we started off, but you can also take some time and we can start.
Well, let's keep
okay,
going.
Sure. It's interesting that you write about the Palmer raids in the book, and it was this really roundups of thousands of radicals with the intention of deporting them, and many were deported. But it seemed like there was a backlash to it, an institutional backlash, where it seemed like they had gone too far with this.
Yeah, there was some internal fighting. You take a deep dive into the politics. There's personalities, there's power bases and such. And there's exposure on, you know, the First Amendment. I mean, I think we saw this pretty recently with the Jimmy Kimmel stuff. It really is a sacrosanct thing about the United States. It's a very peculiar thing about the United States. And I think even back then, people looked at, you know, the ability to speak and meet and thought, well, you know, this is who we are as Americans. And what was happening in the Palmer raids was, you know, the contrary to that. So there, you know, there's always been a divide between this kind of authoritarian, you know, or even fascist impulse and then this larger, you know, democratic sensibility. And I think that was getting worked out then. The reality is like, the repression in the United States is not really all that unique. I mean, there's various arguments and, you know, ways in which things are couched. But what was striking to me, and I don't think most people realize it, is that, you know, something as basic as standing on the street and saying, you know, a revolution, it would be a good thing in this country. You know, it's what our forefathers did. It's what we should do again. That was actually a felony, you know, for the better part of the 20th century. Not only was it a felony, but people were imprisoned, and it was used as a pretty sharp cudgel. It was used first through the criminal anarchy statutes, and then in 1940, there was this law called the Smith Act, which was essentially an immigration law that said, you know, if you're a communist, you can't be here. We're going to deport you. And also, it had a stipulation that if you write, print, advocate the teaching of a doctrine of overthrowing the government of the United States, that's a felony. You know, the Smith Act was adopted in 1940 as the U.S. was approaching World War II. It was first used against the Socialist Workers Party, I believe, in Minnesota. I think about over a dozen of them were tried and convicted and imprisoned because the Trotskyist view on World War II, unlike the communists, was this is an imperialist war and we oppose it. The communists kind of stood aside as the Trotskyists were being targeted and, you know, essentially applauded because the, you know, Stalin and Trotsky, you know, were arch enemies and such.
The rest of the Teamsters didn't like those Trotskyists either. That broader Teamster union also wanted to suppress that chapter because of their.
So it's a real problem because 1940, the Trotskyists are targeted with this. 1948, 1949, the entire leadership of the Communist Party USA are indicted under the Smith Act. 11 of their leaders are put, their top leaders are arrested, put on trial, and imprisoned. The bulk of them served 5 years in federal prison, basically taken out of the political scene in the dead center of the Second Red Scare. Several of them actually went underground. A couple actually successfully evaded the government for many years. eventually turned themselves in, but they were taken out of the equation. I mean, this thing of going underground is, it's problematic if you are a, you know, if you want to be a vibrant and vital political force.
Right. And so the communists had sort of gone underground in the 20s after this first Red Scare, and they really emerge again during the Popular Front movement as like a more visible force that actually has some connections with FDR, some like this sort of tenuous relationship. And you have this great quote of him sort of addressing this communist connected youth group, 39 or something. But behind the scenes, he's also still working with Hoover. And Hoover's like, give my group, the FBI, some more funding so I can keep working on these lists and keep rounding these people up, or at least getting the list ready for when we need to round them up and get them all out, right? So it seems like the FBI makes a play here with World War II on the horizon to increase its bureaucratic power.
You know, as I went into, I think that's pretty accurate. I needed to try to understand Roosevelt better, and I'm sure there are people who are more expert than I am, but I think Roosevelt tends to get a pass in large part for what he did, not only with the FBI, but I mean, you know, for crying out loud, I mean, who developed nuclear weapons? I mean, FDR was like the motive force behind that. Harry Truman, you know, pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. I mean, and, you know, I guess you could ask the question, is the world a better place for having nuclear weapons? I don't think it is. I mean, some people argue, well, you know, it concluded World War II, but, you know, I don't think the history of nuclear weapons has really been written yet. You know, for one, but the other thing about FDR is, you know, he's kind of portrayed as this guy who's soft on communism. I think his wife was, Eleanor, was much more willing to countenance communists. FDR, I think, was much more anti-communist. He has this statement in the midst of the Depression circa, like, I believe, 33, 34, saying, you know, look, and I'll paraphrase, you know, you Republicans, you keep complaining about communists, you know, but we've actually done something about it. You know, you can't just like beat them on the head. You've got to, you know, you've got to deal with the soil that is engendering them, i.e. the economy, you know, the rabid inequality, and, you know, to say nothing of the Jim Crow racism and you know, polarization that exists in the United States. And FDR, as he is looking at World War II on the horizon, is like, I can't have these communists, you know, in my business. You know, they need to be brought to heel. They are unstable. I mean, first they're making deals with Germany to have a non-aggression pact. Yeah. You know, I can't deal with that. So he gives Hoover a lot of power. And I think the historiography, you know, basically does a wag the tail thing as if Hoover is running the agenda. But, you know, in fact, he serves the administration. I mean, yeah, he's a careerist. And is he a megalomaniac, you know, if you want to use that term? And, you know, does he have his own bureaucratic sense of entitlement? I suspect he certainly does. But the reason he stays as long as he is, not because he has the goods on the people he's serving, but there's a material basis for him to stay. He's good at his job, which is protecting the empire from internal enemies, you know, from his standpoint, you know, from FDR to Lyndon Johnson to Richard Nixon and everybody in between.
And so jumping forward to the end of the war, you know, there is this period where the communists and the New Deal administration are somewhat aligned on foreign and domestic policy. This ends with the war, of course, but there's this moment where at least the communists feel, the Communist Party feels, that they've earned all this goodwill, that there's, you know, all of this, these movies and wartime propaganda are showing the U.S. and USSR as partners in this fight. This ends pretty much immediately when the war ends. On one hand, you have millions of returning veterans initiating this massive strike wave, I think the largest in U.S. history. And then moving forward from that, the U.S. is gearing up again for another war, this time against communism in Korea. So how do you see the what are the origins, the material origins, or like just the facts of how the second Red Scare really gets going?
Yeah, it's you have to look at geopolitics, right? I mean, you know, the mythology in the United States is, well, the United States won World War II. The reality is the Soviet Union and the United States won World War II. The Soviets defeated the Nazis, you know, largely defeated the Nazis. And I don't want to belittle the sacrifices Americans made, you know, in that, or you know, other Europeans. But the Soviets had on a level of 20 million people killed. And I've read some books on the war that the Nazis waged, you know, after Barbarossa, you know, when they went into Belarus and the Ukraine, and it was just awful. You know, actually, it's something that deserves as much attention, you know, as the great world atrocities and such. But
yeah, I mean, just in terms of scale, many of the individual battles of the Eastern Front were the biggest battles ever fought in the history of the world.
Yeah, I think Churchill had this pithy phrase that we were diddling around with two or three divisions while, right, you know, the bulk of the German army, you know, were engaged with the Soviets. Yeah, and the U.S. won the war in Asia. They defeated Japan brutally, you know, but they did defeat Japan. I mean, that was a real serious contestation. I mean, Japan, you know, never wanted to invade California, but they did say that Hawaii is the dividing line, the East is ours, which, you know, if you look at what's happening in the world today with China, I mean, there are some similarities to, you know, what, you know, some analyze that China doesn't want to conquer the world. It does want to control a certain section, you know, that this is our bailiwick, but you know, we'll see how all that plays out. But geopolitics is critical. So circa 1945, 1946, you know, there's some people who think this grand alliance of the Soviet Union, the United States, and Britain is going to stay in place, but it doesn't. You know, Stalin is intent on consolidating power in the parts of Europe, you know, that the Soviets, you know, have liberated, essentially. I mean, you could argue, you know, the pluses and minuses of all that. I mean, it was not a, you know, war is not a peaceful thing, and dividing up the map of the globe is a very fraught process. I mean, Stalin was for real about grabbing Poland, Hungary, to say nothing of Romania, Moldova, and, you know, all those places. The U.S., Truman at a certain point says, okay, enough. There's a civil war in Greece. He announces the Truman Doctrine. We're not going to allow the communists to take power in Greece. This is done. Stalin's not getting any more. And that's the beginning of the Cold War, the end of the Grand Alliance. The communists actually support this guy, Henry Wallace, who had been Roosevelt's vice president. Wallace was, you know, it's just interesting to see how the rulers, such as it is, battle this stuff out. I mean, it's real. Wallace is like, let's continue this alliance. Let's have peace, etc. And it's a marginal view. I mean, he runs for president. The communists back him. They're attacked mercilessly. I mean, Wallace wants to have integrated rallies in the South. He's pelted. His security people are beaten up. You know, the anti-communism is pumped out in the media. Wallace loses. I mean, he doesn't do as good as the segregationist candidate and stuff. But this is the beginning of the Cold War, and it doesn't get better from there. It gets much worse.
When would you say the hysteria really begins? Because I'm most familiar with it. I grew up in Westchester, so I'm most familiar with it from the story of the Peekskill Riot, which is 49. But in your book, you talk about how they start rounding up some high-level communists around 45, and this is when the House Un-American Activities Committee really starts having a lot of hearings. But it seemed like it was still a bit shaky. It was still kind of unpopular. to have these hearings. There's a lot of pressure against HUAC for, you know, not going after the Klan, for instance. So, yeah, when like, what really kicks off this media backlash?
Well, the way I would answer that is I don't think the media ever was very generous to communists. I mean, they, you know, really portrayed them as, I guess the word other, you know, is kind of the old, it's old now, but it's a term of trying to marginalize them. But communists are never looked at benignly at all. Even during the Popular Front period, there's an extreme wariness. You know, even when, during World War II, when you had something on the level of 13,000 communists joining the U.S. military, fighting and dying, you know, in the U.S.'s cause in World War II, even then, the wiretaps stay up on the leadership of the Communist Party. Ben Davis, black city councilman from New York, the historian of Davis's life actually acquired the massive file from him, and it's just replete with transcripts and such. So that's one thing. It's like the communists are never liked, but it does, you know, get turned up to 11 in 47, 48, and 49. It starts with the Hollywood 10 case, mm-hmm. you know, where, well, we've got all these communists in Hollywood and they're pumping their doctrine out through the movies. You know, meanwhile, you know, you have John Wayne in movies where he portrays Big Jim McLean, a HUAC researcher, and he's this big hero. I mean, talk about, you know, propaganda in films. And I don't think the communists actually did anything comparable, but, you know, the Hollywood 10 are sent to prison for a year. You know, directors and writers, prestigious intellectuals who, you know, the anti-intellectual strain in the U.S. makes them, you know, good fodder to, you know, put them, you know, in front of Congress, humiliate them and send them to prison. But it just keeps getting worse and worse, you know. And by the time Joe McCarthy comes on the scene, the senator from Wisconsin, who is a demagogue of the first order and pretty effective at portraying this notion of communists everywhere, you know, he gets free flight. But even before that, the thing that got everybody excited was the spy scares, because the communists did have a secret apparatus. I mean, why wouldn't they? I mean, you know, they'd been marginalized. There were these laws that prescribed their activity. You know, there was an element of secrecy they would need to conduct to be able to function. But beyond that, they did wholeheartedly support the Soviet Union. So was there espionage? I believe there was. You know, I think it's documented, especially during World War II. They wanted the Soviets to win, and some of them actually sent secrets. But there was a whole thing in the press where, you know, day after day, all these revelation of these secret conspiracies. So, you know, that got people in the mass in a certain frame of mind to look at these communists as anti-American and dangerous and sneaky and, you know, elements of truth to all of it. But it served a wider agenda of, like, bringing this force to heal, to be able to contain it.
Yeah, two particular stories that brings to mind from this period is, one, the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Convenient narrative to say that if and when the Soviet Union got nuclear weapons, it would have because we, you know, their agents stole it from us. Seems like maybe they would have developed it themselves, but, you know, like you said, there was this spying going on. And so the Rosenbergs were kind of made into a show trial case that was particularly effective, because that was really a huge challenge to U.S. supremacy after the war, you know, the fact that the USSR now has nuclear weapons. And then the case of Paul Robeson, like we mentioned before, he appeared at this conference in Paris alongside W.B. Du Bois and other radical figures opposed to the Korean War, saying that black Americans would not, or I think actually just saying black people everywhere would not fight a war against communism. And this becomes a huge backlash against Robeson, who had previously a Communist Party aligned or at least friendly figure had been a national hero the way we talk about Jackie Robinson today, because he had integrated football and stage and screen and was a deeply beloved figure. And so they were able to use this HUAC hearing and the, you know, these quotes in the press to make him basically, you know, unable to work in the United States, unable to travel. And that this happens in 49, and that seems to be sort of the chilling effect that proceeds for the next decade. If you're a communist, you kind of had to really keep your head down, and often you would be dragged before a hearing and had to rat out your friends to save your job or to avoid jail time.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because Martin Dees, who was a congressman from Texas, he was the initial chair of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. It's called HUAC. They transposed the C and the U. Dees was temporarily out of office when Harry Truman came in as president. FDR died. Truman becomes president. Dees writes a letter. Dees or dies. Feel free to correct me, listeners. But anyway, he writes a letter to Truman and says, you know, here's how you're going to deal with the communists. And he outlines a number of specific things. First, denaturalize, you know, communists who have come to this country. Deport people who are here who have tenuous residency. You know, eliminate communists from the union. Pass a law making the Communist Party illegal. You know, institute loyalty oaths. So he writes this letter, which it's not as if Truman gets the letter and then implements the whole thing. I mean, I think he has somebody in his Department of Justice answer and say, yeah, thank you, don't worry, we're on this. But what's revealing is pretty much everything Martin Dies outlines is implemented in within the next 5 years, including the Taft-Hartley Act, which is a huge blow to the communists who have, you know, I don't know that they have, you know, thousands and thousands of union members, you know, in the party, but they do have influential leaders, especially in the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, an organization they helped build in the Furriers Union, the Electrical Union. You know, they're important positions. Taft-Hartley says, if you're a communist, you can't be a union officer. So it forces the communists to either, you know, pull out of those leadership posts or stay in the posts and drop being communists. So it really neutralizes their impact there. You know, that's one of Dies' proposals. You know, it has a huge impact, but it's part of an overall agenda. You know, in tandem with that, I mean, the thing with that you're saying about Robeson is, so yeah, Robeson's in Europe. He makes a statement essentially saying, look, we don't want another war. That's the gist of what he's saying. You know, it's not in the interest of black people or white people. It is kind of twisted into a kind of a Fox News moment. You know, Paul Robeson's telling black people not to be patriotic. And a huge, you know, storm is kicked up in Peekskill, where Robeson is going to do a summer concert. I think traditionally he's been welcomed up there. But it coincides with the indictment and the beginning of the trial of 11 leaders of the Communist Party under the Smith Act. You know, they're being put on trial for, you know, advocating revolution and communism. And the funny thing about it is it's because they reconstituted the party in 1945. So Earl Browder, who is this, essentially he's kind of a social democratic communist, nominally disbands the Communist Party toward the end of World War II. He's envisioning a situation in which the party can work with, you know, the capitalist class, you know, much more harmoniously, kind of in sync with the alliance between the U.S. and Soviets. He dissolves the Communist Party nominally, creates this Communist Political Association. Stalin intervenes and says, no, you have to reconstitute the party and you have to do some criticism of this guy, Browder. Browder is driven out of the party in disgrace, even though, you know, everybody had been behind him. I mean, there was actually, it's funny, there was a whole cult of personality of sorts of Browder. People had his picture up on the wall.
There's a little one today, too.
Say again?
There's a little Browder cult going on today, too.
Is that true? I'm actually not familiar.
There's some like patriotic communists who really like.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm sure they're a whole story. But how are you going to call yourself the, you know, the American Revolutionary? What's their name? They have America in their name.
Yeah, the American Communist Party. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's. That's not going to fly with a lot of people. Anyway, I mean, the name. I mean, we'll leave.
No, it's not working at all.
Yeah, which is probably good. Browder is thrown out of the party, and this is where the Smith Act comes in. The party is reconstituted. The Communist Party is reconstituted. So this is what they're charged with in 48 in the indictment, and this is what they're put on trial to reconstituting the party. And it's like a huge, long trial. It's kind of akin to... for people who are older, the Chicago conspiracy trial, it's like a huge media event. The communists lose pretty badly, even though it's in their constitution. We don't want to overthrow the government, but that's not good enough. I mean, the Communist Manifesto is actually read into the trial transcript as evidence of why this group has violated the Smith Act. And they're sent to prison, or several of them go underground. Gus Hall, who becomes the leader, he attempts to flee to Mexico. An informer snitches him out. He's apprehended. They add 3 years to his term. But the rest of them, the bulk of them, end up in prison, you know, at a time when the attacks are relentless. And this first Smith Act trial gives way to the second Smith Act trial. So systematically, the government and the FBI are just tearing off the leadership, decapitating this group. And then, you know, in sync with the trial itself is this incident that you've mentioned, the Peekskill riot, where the American Legion and other, you know, right-wing forces in Peekskill organize to basically keep a concert from Paul Robeson happening in Peekskill. They basically... you know, go after the setup crew the night before and hold people kind of hostage, including, you know, women and children who are setting up and just, you know, destroy the stage. The concert is put off. A week later, it happens and it's successful. But again, you know, as people are leaving, there's this gauntlet that's established with the state police on local police, you know, reinforce, where people are driving down the road and they're just being hit with rocks, you know, relentlessly serious rocks. People are hospitalized. Somebody loses their finger. A couple of the Smith Act defendants, you know, are hit. One of them is hospitalized. You know, Woody Guthrie has a song. People can dig it out. It's a great song. It's called My 30,000. It's part of the Wilco and Billy Bragg, Mermaid Avenue sessions. It wasn't on the original album, but it's, if you got Spotify or Apple Music, you'll find it. It's called My 30,000, and it's a really great recitation of the Peekskill riot. And it almost sounds like the battle hymn of the Republic. It's very exhilarating.
Yeah, and you also, I should mention, you have another book that's more focused on the repression of the folk music scene, Folk Singer in the Bureau, which we also did an episode about. So I'll put links to that in the show notes. And obviously, yeah, something you and I
Music is a lot more fun than COINTELPRO, I tell you.
Well, let's move a little forward and get to COINTELPRO. But first, you made an interesting point in the book when you're talking about these Smith Act trials, which was that the Communist Party attempted not to defend themselves on free speech grounds, but on the fact that they're charter prohibited overthrowing the government, and they were trying to say, like, look, I know what Marx and Engels said, but we're not doing that anymore. We're just trying to be a legitimate political party, like in coalition with other parties. And you seem to think that this was a mistake. And I wonder if things would have turned out any differently if they had defended themselves purely on free speech, or, you know, if the writing was on the wall either way.
Well, in LA, they're leadership had, in California, the leadership had been put on trial under the Smith Act. This happened after the initial leadership, and they did more mount a defense based on, you know, the right of advocacy in general. And eventually a Supreme Court ruling came in 1957, the Yates decision, which acceded to some of that and kind of took a lot of power out of the Smith Act. As far as, you know, your question, as you're asking it, you're actually making me think, well, would things have been any different? And I guess the answer is, well, no, they weren't, because that is the way things went. You know what I mean? It's not like the thing with counterfactuals is they're fun in terms of trying to think. And I'm probably challenging my own analysis here. Counterfactuals are fun in terms of how things could have gone, but it's conceivable that even given the whole atmosphere in 49, I don't know if they could have said anything different.
Sure, but maybe I phrase it as too much of a counterfactual, but it's just an interesting thing to think about when we're talking about repression today as well, because one way you could take it is like, well, this repression is going to target free speech, so I have to change my speech. And the other way to take it is, I'm not going to let them take away my free speech. I'm going to continue to say and advocate for what I believe in, and maybe launching a defense campaign based on that. We saw the outpouring of support for Jimmy Kimmel, right? Obviously, it would be really big to connect that in some way to the more serious political repression against the left that we're beginning to see in the United States. And I think free speech is probably going to be a pretty big tool in fighting that repression. But depending on the context of what group you are, how you're trying to... For example, we changed the name of this podcast because we just don't want the heat of having Antifa in the name. But we still want to... We still feel like we should say what we need to say. But this is maybe a good way to transition to the 60s, where you do have this rebirth of like serious revolutionary organizing and the new left. And the CPUSA has been so badly damaged from the repression and from the facts of what's happened that they're no longer a huge factor, but they're still being targeted now by a heavy level of infiltration. This is, of course, for those of us who love your books, is where you really shine, like showing the peculiarities and particularities of this repression. Did you find anything really new and exciting for this book?
I found a lot, but I want to step back because sure. I think the point you made on free speech is really important. It just makes me think, and this is where putting the whole concept of counterfactuals aside, there is a question of what can we learn from history? And I guess the thing I'm learning the more I get into all of this is, you know, the left, such as it is, needs to be very good at playing well with others and not, you know, setting a bar so high that it becomes isolated and marginalized. And this is not just a rhetorical scheme or a matter of manipulation. I mean, it's got to flow from some actual bedrock principle. But yeah, I mean, there is this First Amendment in the United States. And if you can bring millions of people in behind that, you should do that, and you should mean it, and you should be sincere in that, and, you know, believe what you want to believe and have those discussions and promote that. But, you know, don't, you know, lock yourself in a room or, you know, get yourself in a corner. So that's just on that. But as far as the 60s, you know, so things change. So Khrushchev gets up in 1956, and basically, it's heresy. He's basically, you know, Stalin is like the Pope, and Khrushchev gets up and says, you know, I'm not even sure there's Jesus. And it just creates a whole crisis of global communism. And Stalin is being called out for this cult of personality. He's, you know, Khrushchev is saying, you know, people were killed, you know, many thousands of people were killed, you know, in these political purges, and it just totally disrupts, you know, the international communist movement. The Communist Party itself, which had been able to kind of hold it together despite the second Red Scare. I mean, they'd gone from maybe about 80,000 people in 1949 down to about 20,000, which, yeah, that's a considerable drop, but it's still a substantial organization in 1956. Once Khrushchev speaks, they dwindle down to several thousand. People are just, you know, totally disoriented and disenchanted.
And almost entirely in New York as well.
Yeah. And the party, in my sense, it becomes something qualitatively different. You know, rather than this force to lead a more mass movement toward, you know, this vision of radical socialism, it becomes this agent of a foreign power. Mm-hmm. It becomes the advocate of the Soviet Union. And I'm not saying that everybody in the party, you know, that was the only thing that they were promoting, but objectively, they're much more doing that, which is why the term counterintelligence is used. And I don't know that I actually quite understood it, because counterintelligence can be a thing of just going after an organization, but its most utilized meaning is when you're trying to go in after a foreign power and you're trying to destabilize them, and you're using a kind of a counterinsurgency, almost elements of warfare to disrupt them. Counterintelpro starts in 1956. If you actually read the initial initiating document, they refer to Khrushchev's speech and they say, look, there's an opportunity here. This party is in a mess. They're in chaos. Khrushchev has created a whole storm of disarray, and we can disrupt this group internally. I mean, part of why they thought they could disrupt the group internally is they had these two brothers, Morris and Jack Childs, who had been Browder people, and they had been disenchanted. And this savvy FBI agent in Chicago recruited Morris Childs, who had worked on the Daily Worker staff as an editor, to become an FBI informant. Childs will remain in the party and an FBI informant until like around 1980. He will become effectively Gus Hall's Secretary of State. He goes to China, he meets with Mao, he meets with Brezhnev, and he also brings back bags of money to essentially fund the CP, you know, throughout this period when it has a dwindling, you know, economic base, you know, due to its lack of membership. But COINTELPRO is, this program is established, and most people who do know about COINTELPRO think about the efforts against Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party, things I've written about. But the almost 60% of the operations are targeted against the CPUSA, you know, including especially, you know, their top leadership and such. And there are some, there's some high comedy there, and there's just some appalling stuff. The most appalling thing I came across was the case of this Philadelphia communist, Aaron Libson, who was a communist. He was a closeted gay man. I think around 65, 66, he was in a tea room in Philly, which was I don't know if the term is still used, but it was a gay hookup place in a park. He's arrested, you know, in a sting operation. The FBI gets wind of it and makes sure it's in the paper. So it's in the Philadelphia Inquirer, I believe, the next day, and Libson's, you know, there with his family reading this, and he's like, oh shit, my life is over. You know, I mean, in 66 to be outed as gay is kind of a big deal. So he enacts a plan to kill himself, which fortunately doesn't, you know, isn't successful. But the FBI basically does an after report saying, you know, he's kicked out of the party. The party's humiliated. It's all good. This is a good COINTELPRO. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't care if people die, and, you know, probably some of them are happy.
Yeah, that was a really incredible story that I had not heard before. Even, you know, I'd done some research into Mattachine and, you know, the gay rights organizing leading up to Stonewall. And that was one thing I hadn't heard. But of course, it's not too surprising, because the Communist Party does have this historic chauvinism that was homophobic, and that was one of the fractures that allowed pretty sophisticated COINTELPRO operations as a way to split it up, including the Sino-Soviet split, you know, the New Left versus Orthodox sort of splits as well. They they really saw these fracture lines, and you know, some of it was kind of slapstick and weird and ineffective, but they did a lot to exacerbate those tensions.
Yeah, there's also something in Ben Davis's file, who's, you know, really an important historical figure. I mean, the communists don't get near enough credit for what they did against Jim Crow and the whole, you know, apartheid system in the U.S. And Ben Davis was on the front lines of that. I mean, you know, especially in the 30s, the communists, including a lot of white communists, I mean, they were willing to go to the mat for the freedom of black people. And, you know, black people, you know, joined in with them and stuff. So I just think it's a part of history that needs a lot more emphasis. But Ben Davis, you know, he's a true believer. He's dying of cancer. All these guys smoke, you know. But anyway, in the 60s, early 60s, and the FBI is reading this and they're thinking, well, you know, Ben Davis has been having problems because the Communist Party really hasn't been on the front lines of the Black Freedom Movement. And, you know, Davis, you know, is passionate about that issue. And he's dying of cancer. And the FBI is like, well, what we ought to do is, you know, let's go have a heart-to-heart with the guy. Let's get him to do a deathbed conversion, you know, so he can kind of torpedo some of the prestige of the Communist Party. I mean, Davis doesn't do that. He dies. But it just shows you how manipulative and, you know, nothing is off limits as far as, you know, going after this group from the standpoint of the FBI and the larger structure that supports the FBI.
Do you have time to talk for like maybe half an hour more?
Can we take a 5-minute break?
That's what I was going to suggest.
Well, yeah, I'm just going to brew a coffee and put something in my mouth.
All right. So we're going to have more with Aaron J. Leonard after the break. Subscribe to the show at patreon.com/thiswreckage to hear the rest of our conversation about COINTELPRO moving into the 70s and then eventually catching up with some thoughts on the repression that we're witnessing today. We'll get Aaron's thoughts on this as a historian. If you want to hear that, sign up at patreon.com/thiswreckage and check out our pin post. We've got a fall promotion. Upgrade your membership and receive a copy of Jared Shanahan's Every Fire Needs a Little Help, and or my book, I Want to Believe, Pasazem, UFOs, and Apocalypse Communism. You get those if you sign up at the annual level. And if you sign up at any level, you can hear all of our bonus content, subscribe to our Discord community, and support the show. And we really appreciate it. See you after the break.
Survive red scares, white terrors. Suspicious you snitch like Kundera. Feng Shui where she put the black mirror. Shot in the arm was Death Row Rivera. True romance, true love, slow jams. Dealing lightning out both hands. Gave the middleman a couple grand. God Fieri hamburgers, words bombs, be the best earners. Handfuls of tongues like I did a murder. Passing L some shit you never heard of. Now you feeling self-conscious and nervous. Shit, might have to up the price. That was scheme, pyramids is Herbalife. Sandwich dream, yeah, you heard him right. The future's bright.
Okay, I'm back.
All right, you got your coffee?
I got my coffee. So yeah, that's the thing. Doing podcasts, you know, I kind of like them. But I'd rather be writing because then you can go back and delete things. Uh-huh. And you know what I mean?
Well, that's why I like to edit.
I appreciate that.
I get the editor's privilege. Okay.
By the way, this is from my daughter. This is my own.
It's a mug that says, ask me about my book. And I'm about to do that. I've been doing it. I don't need the mug to tell me. But yeah, maybe you could go drink that in public and see if you get some sales that way.
Yeah, it's workable, but my daughter has a pretty good sense of humor, so I had to give her props for that.
All right. So I think we're pretty much in the 70s, and this is a main thing I want to ask you about in the current context, which is that previously in the book, we're not talking about terrorism, really. Terrorism had been a term that had been used for, you know, a century beforehand, but it wasn't really a focus of this repressive apparatus. But it really does start to become a major sort of boogeyman in the 70s. And I was wondering if what your perspective is on like how and why that starts exactly or when.
Well, I think the FBI lost an incredible, not just the FBI, but the U.S. power structure lost an incredible amount of credibility through the course of the 60s. You know, one thing I don't think gets enough attention is, well, two points. The U.S. lost the war in Vietnam. You know, it's not ambiguous. It's not like it was a draw. I mean, they lost. They had to pull out. They lost tens of thousands of people. The Vietnamese lost millions. The U.S. spent billions of dollars, which had a severe impact in the 70s. But when you lose wars, it has an incredible negative impact. Governments fall, leaders fall. I mean, arguably, the reason Nixon, you know, was driven from power was more about the Vietnam War's resolution than it was about Watergate. I mean, his saving grace was he was able to do the rapprochement with China, which kind of leveled the geopolitical playing field. It allowed him to exit Vietnam without the U.S. being, you know, totally humiliated. But the FBI, you know, basically waged this covert counterinsurgency against, you know, internal security, you know, through the course of Vietnam, and the war was not successful, and the secrets started to come out. You know, this brave group of, I believe, Catholic pacifists, you know, did a surreptitious raid on a regional office in Media, Pennsylvania, and stole all the files the FBI had there, and discovered one document that had a subhead called COINTELPRO, which basically led to the exposure and unraveling. So, you know, J. Edgar Hoover talked a lot about, he was very conscientious about not embarrassing the Bureau, which is a euphemism for being exposed. You know, they were doing things that were quasi-legal and absolutely illegal. So the FBI's whole predicate and legitimacy was thrown in the air through the course of things like COINTELPRO being revealed, which led to new attorney general guidelines. I mean, I don't even know what historians are going to say about what's going on now with the Department of Justice. It's dizzying. But back when things, you know, for lack of a better term, made sense, Jimmy Carter's attorney general established new guidelines that said, you know, you can't go after people for what they're saying. You know, if they're operating within the realm of the Constitution, they should be able to do it. The FBI was effectively put out of the domestic internal security business. You know, they just closed down all these investigations. They, you know, fired informants or rerouted them and stuff, with a certain caveat, which is that if you were an agent of a foreign power, they could stay on you. And they did stay on the Communist Party. And there were this new court was established, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was established that allowed the government to get authority to wiretap certain groups if they were violating, you know, the strictures of foreign, you know, working for a foreign power. So for the broader effort against domestic subversion, if you will, it transitions towards terrorism. And these are people who are, you know, there is a whole cohort coming out of the late 60s, early 70s that are into political, well, they're not into, but they're advocates of urban guerrilla warfare, you know, acts of, you know, political violence of a certain sense. And these are used, you know, going into the 80s. And there's a whole global thing of certain things being branded as terrorism. And that's kind of what's still in operation. I think what's going on with this current administration is almost a cake and eat it too. They want to just kind of go after speech, you know, like people advocating for Palestine, but then they want to brand those people as terrorists, you know, to kind of stay within the laws. How this all gets resolved is, you know, I'd say anybody's guess, but it's like it's going to get resolved. But it's a very volatile topography.
Yeah. And it, you know, just reading the this through history, it seems like it's a return to the logic of criminal anarchy as a charge, right? Because it's not only saying your propaganda by the deed is obviously a crime, but also you're just saying, like, you support the deed, it appears to be now either a crime or something that law enforcement is asked to monitor and target in ways that it couldn't be before, although we were certainly on that track. And yeah, so I think it's an interesting historical rhyme that the specter of anarchism via Antifa is returning again. Of course, it began with the equation of anyone who's pro-Palestine to being pro-Hamas, therefore pro-support of a foreign terrorist organization. And it seems like Trump is going to call Antifa a foreign terrorist organization as well, but he hasn't done it yet. But it doesn't seem like the distinction may not really matter anymore. But it does appear that now, the one thing Trump's been saying quite a bit, which also plays into the history of communist repression, is that burning a flag is incitement, because when people see a flag burning, then they start going crazy. This is how he always puts it. He's referring to some video in Portland that I haven't seen. But he said during his Antifa roundtable thing, is like, we are taking away the First Amendment for flag burning.
Flag burning. All over the country, they're burning flags. All over the world, they burn the American flag. And as you know, through a very sad court, I guess it was a 5-4 decision, they called it freedom of speech. But there's another reason, which is perhaps much more important. It's called death. Because what happens when you burn a flag is the area goes crazy. If you have hundreds of people, they go crazy. You can do other things. You can burn this piece of paper. But when you burn the American flag, it incites riots at levels that we've never seen before. People go crazy.
1 year penalty for inciting riots. We took the freedom of speech away because that's been through the courts, and the court said, you have freedom of speech. But what has happened is when they burn a flag, it agitates and irritates crowds. They've never seen anything like it on both sides, and you end up with riots. So we're going on that basis. We're looking at it from not from the freedom of speech, which I always felt strongly about, but never paid.